thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 14 for the 10th of October 2007. Where is the art? I'm Dan Cohen. We're back again for another episode of Digital Campus, and around our virtual roundtable, the usual suspects. We have Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org and historyconversations.org, his new podcast. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Dan.
And Mills Kelly from edwired.org. Hey, Mills.
Hi, Dan.
You get more feedback on your prodding on HNET and the question we discussed last time, Mills, on your blog?
Yeah, a little bit more, and I've certainly had a lot of comments posted on the blog, which is great, and the discussion has really gone back and forth. And also on a couple of the HNET lists, the discussion has continued, so it's been fun to watch.
Great. Has the trend line changed at all, or are people thinking about some of these new technologies and sort of moving listservs into them?
Well, certainly on the H German list, there's been a lot of discussion about moving to some sort of hybridized format where they still continue to have some sort of email list, but they also have a blog which would allow them to do the kinds of things that we discussed in the podcast last time, while also maintaining the kind of foundational structure of the email list. So I think that's kind of an interesting approach to it.
Sounds great. Well, I guess part of the discussion last week was about, you know, opening up the academic discussion to the wider world and moving things out of these little gated or walled gardens that we sort of make for ourselves in academia. And there were a bunch of interesting stories this week or in the past 2 weeks since our last podcast sort of on this theme. Much of this happening at Harvard, which I guess... for better or for worse, and we won't tease our Harvard grad here, Tom Scheinfeld, but what Harvard does sort of have an influence on the nation, and it looks like they're moving pretty strongly toward open access for faculty materials, and there was an interesting op-ed piece or editorial in the Harvard Crimson by the students saying that faculty should be posting their articles online and making them freely available. It looks like pressures are sort of pushing in that direction finally for more openness, for academic open repositories for the work of faculty, and for publishing in some kind of more open format than your regular gated journal on a site. Am I wrong about this, or is this just a lot of bluster at Harvard to say how great they are? Tom,
we're just waiting for Tom to go first.
You want me to comment on Harvard? Okay.
Well, I guess,
it is interesting. A couple of years ago, I got an email from one of the alumni lists saying that there was some gated resource that I could access that could give me access to, you know, essentially their course management system, their Blackboard or WebCT installation, and that I could, you know, surf around and see what was going on the various in the various courses going on at Harvard College. And I actually tried to register, and even for an alum with my, you know, post.harvard.edu address or whatever it is, even there it was really pretty difficult to get access to that, and then to find my way around and to actually find I was looking actually for a syllabus of a course I took as an undergraduate, because I had remembered a source, and I couldn't remember the name of the author, and I wanted to find it, and I wasn't able to. So I mean, my experience, even just my personal experience, has been that an elite university like Harvard, they hadn't moved in that direction very much at all until I guess now very recently. And I sort of think it's about time, especially for universities like these very big research universities, where so much of their funding comes from public sources. I mean, you know, Harvard is a private university, and you know, Stanford and MIT and Princeton and just to give you a little jab, Dan, are private universities, but they really are. So much of their funding comes from major federal research grants,
right,
and or private philanthropic organizations that are, you know, tax-free nonprofits. So much of their money coming from, and so much of the research that's being produced coming from public sources of funding, it seems like it's really about time that they started opening some of that up to the public that's paying for it. So I think it's a good move, whether it's just a gesture or whether it's something a new change in course is a good question. But it's definitely about time.
Right. Well, go ahead, Mills.
I would agree. I think it's absolutely time for this kind of material to be opened up. You know, I mean, we have this debate here in relation to the podcasting platform that George Mason is implementing through iTunes, and whether the material should be gated and or not, whether it should be available. And you know, for us, it seems to me more of a no-brainer because we're a state agency. But even I think the private universities, I think Tom's hit on the key point there, which is that so much of their funding comes from public agencies, and so how can it be that material should be kept away from public inspection?
I won't go off on a tangent, but you could tell about this sort of public funding angle when all of the universities got really scared over the past week because of a bill that's making its way through the House to take away federal money from universities that don't do enough to stop illegal trafficking in MP3s and other copyrighted materials on campus. I mean, isn't the Harvard Faculty Council, you know, they made a pretty bold move here to make, you know, manuscripts of articles available, to create an online system of open access. And much of their credit, I think, made it opt out, which sort of naturally encourages professors to, you have to actively say you don't want to participate in this. But it seems like a lot of these open access institutional repositories are sort of opt-in and require, you know, the kind of active participation of the professors. Aren't we the problem here, Mills and Tom?
Oh, yeah, I think absolutely we are, because I think that we've developed, for really no good reason in academia, this culture of privacy about our work, where we're scared of what's going to happen when people see it in an unpolished form, or we're scared of what's going to happen when they see it in a polished form. And you know, we're especially scared of what might happen if they could see what was going on in our classes. And all of this really works against our interests, and against what we're supposed to be doing, which is circulating knowledge among one another. And I'm not really sure why this culture developed, but I mean, all you have to do is have a conversation with people about, if you're going to a conference and you have to send in an electronic version of your paper, and that those papers are going to be posted online. People freak out about this. Oh my God, somebody's going to steal my work and use it as their own. And, you know, all of us here at CH&M make the same argument over and over again, which is no. If you post it online with a date stamp on it, then if they steal it, it's pretty obvious that it was stolen.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a great marketing opportunity, I think, that's being missed here. That I was surprised when a lot of universities didn't follow MIT's OpenCourseWare lead. It's been almost 5 years, and for Harvard to kind of begin to match some of that, you know, we're opening up our university and our scholarship. You know, we also were interested and maybe a little bit amused by University of California at Berkeley's new space or channel, I guess it is, on youtube.com/UC Berkeley, which is just, I think, a tremendous marketing opportunity for them, where they put up some of their lectures and courses. And let's listen a little bit into the UC Berkeley channel on YouTube.
You see a place that's alive with purpose and passion.
you see a place inspired by a long tradition of untraditional excellence. You see a place built by the people, for the people, of California, the nation, and the world. What do you see? You see Berkeley.
Oh, what a beautiful ending.
Yeah, I'm moved. I mean, was moved when I first saw that video during the Cal Tennessee game that I caught a couple weeks ago. So I mean, it really is a marketing thing. They're marketing on YouTube just the same way that they're marketing during their football games. So,
right. Well, universities out there, take note. That was the 276,133rd time that video has been seen. It's just tremendous. I mean, publicity and, but also, I mean, I, you know, obviously we're being a little bit facetious. I think it's, you know, great. They've got some really interesting courses here, that people could take, online. I mean, everything from, you know, ultraviolet radiation and electrical engineering to, you know, a course by a professor on nonviolence and sort of a historical overview from, you know, Mahatma Gandhi to the American Civil Rights Movement and Martin Luther King Jr. You know, it's really a kind of nice set of courses. I love their version of Physics for Poets, at least that's what it was called at Princeton. It's called Physics for Future Presidents. As it says, stressing conceptual understanding rather than the math that's normally associated with physics. Anyway, a nice channel, and I think, you know, it's just brilliant to sort of break out of the pack and put this up there quickly. I don't think it's, you know, really that difficult to do. And I think open access is going to become, I think, more and more prominent, you know, not only as a sharing tool, but as a marketing tool for universities.
And I think to their credit, I think Berkeley has been at the head of this pack. I know that they have a very strong presence already on iTunes, not like George Mason's presence, which is closed through iTunes U, but which is mostly, I believe, open through just the general iTunes music store. And you know, it really does, it underscores the point that especially if you're let's say a full professor or a tenured associate professor at somewhere like UC Berkeley or at Harvard, you really, why are you worried about someone seeing your lectures, or why are you worried about pre-publishing an article somewhere? I mean, you have the stature, you have the reputation already. And it just seems like this is people are increasingly realizing this.
Yes, indeed. We'll have to get our youtube.com/digitalcampus page up soon, won't we? the other big area of news for the past 2 weeks has been, and it's also kind of related, I think, in terms of, you know, new web applications for and sort of the ease of web publishing of academic and library and museum materials. We saw finally the release of the source code for Scriblio, which is the really great WordPress-based OPAC or online library catalog. That's at scriblio.net, scriblio.net. And also, Tom, we at the Center for History and New Media received a new grant from the Institute for Museum and Library Services, the government organization that funds these sorts of things, for a project called Omeka. Maybe do you want to start there? Can you explain Omeka and how it sort of provides a new way for web publishing for libraries and museums?
Sure. Omeka at omeka.org is a new product.
That's Omeka with a K in there. Yes. Sorry.
Right, and just to explain, it's in the vein of using foreign words, and like we did with Zotero. Omeka is a Swahili word which means to display or lay out goods or wares, or to speak out or unpack, and so. Omeka.org is where the software is located. It's currently in private beta, but you can sign up on the site for an invitation and which goes into a queue. And as we have more spaces in the test group, we give those out. It's a web publishing platform designed especially for small museums and historical societies, collecting institutions. But I think it can also be used by scholars and enthusiasts and others for displaying digital, organizing and displaying digital objects in a kind of rich media, rich narrative environment. The idea is that whenever a museum launches an exhibition with an online component, they generally have to contract with a new vendor to build the online exhibition. And that vendor builds some kind of a content management system for the exhibition, but it's a closed content management system. It can't be reused. The materials that are entered into that database are kind of walled off. And the next time they want to mount an exhibition or an online exhibition, they have to hire a new vendor, get a new system. And each time they're paying for this. And so what we wanted to do, and this grows out of work that we've done with lots of museums and collecting institutions, and also in our own projects like the September 11 Digital Archive and the Hurricane Digital Memory Bank and other collecting projects. We realized that it would. That these institutions and really all people who are presenting digital objects online could use a platform that would allow them to very easily launch an online exhibition. And so it's kind of built like Scriblio, which is really built on the WordPress platform. Omeka is built on the WordPress model. It doesn't use WordPress code, but it provides a WordPress-like environment for building online exhibitions. And the model really was the model of the blog, trying to make it as easy for museums and collecting institutions to mount online exhibitions as it is for an ordinary person to launch a blog. And we thought it really should be just that easy, and it really, at this point, is not. So Omeka, hopefully, is a step in that direction, and it is in the test period now, and we should be launching a public beta sometime in the winter. But for Digital Campus listeners, if you'd like to get into the test group, please visit omeka.org. It runs on PHP and MySQL, so it should be open to a lot of people, and it's a 5-minute install. It's a very, very easy, easy install. So please visit omeka.org.
Looks great. I mean, I just congratulations, Tom, on the grant, and also to the really stellar CH&M design team for a really great looking site. And I've of course seen the software, and you know, both on the front end in terms of web design, and also on the back end, as you said, in terms of ease of install, and also I think just as important in terms of maintenance and sort of upgrading. What's really great about the WordPress model that's used by Omeka and Scriblio is that you know, it sort of separates out the design and content and sort of functionality from each other, and you can kind of upgrade one without affecting the other. And the, you know, I think the problem we've all seen is, you know, you get these sort of, as you said, these kind of one-off museum design sites or library, you know, exhibits, and they're very hard to maintain, you know, to upgrade the code, et cetera. One of the great things about WordPress is there's so many blogs out there, and everyone just sort of downloads the new version of WordPress and upgrades the, you know, there might be some behind-the-scenes functionality that changes, but they don't have to redo their design or think about all these issues related to PHP. It's sort of done automatically. So I think these are really great. I think what's really neat about Scriblio is it adds a lot of the functionality that all those YouTube users are used to seeing. I mean, things like tags and, you know, things that we take for as sort of an obvious part of, let's say, a blog or a modern Web 2.0 site, you know, I think is there really in Scriblio. And I think a lot of undergrads and graduate students and faculty are going to find this to be a really nice library website versus what they probably have right now, which is probably a very dated kind of, you know, terminal put on the web kind of an interface. Instead, you get a really nice looking way of kind of browsing through a kind of web-based version of the catalog. You know, you can do what's called faceted browsing. So you can kind of, as you get a, let's say you do a search and you get search results, you can narrow that down by author or by set of years or subject headings or things like that. And, you know, I think these kinds of things are increasingly easy to implement. Indeed, we're playing around at the George Mason Libraries with some WordPress-based sort of content management system for library objects. And I think they're going to look better, they're going to function better, and they're going to really, I guess, ultimately, Tom, isn't the point to, you know, get to the material you want to look at? I mean, you know, find the objects on an Omeka-based site that you want to study further, or, you know, compare items, or do these sorts of things that have been really difficult to do on your basic, you know, museum site or library site.
Absolutely. I mean, to both provide the users with the kind of tools that they're looking for, like tagging facilities and you know, one of the things we're building into Omeka is a My Archive, we're calling it, feature, where it allows users to list things as their favorites and save them in their own little bucket so that they can go back to those later, take notes on those materials. We have, much like WordPress and I'm sure Scriblio is using this functionality, we have a theming engine and a plugin engine. So it makes it very easy to extend the software to do different things and to engage. And I think this is key with these projects where, as you said, Dan, where the function at the kind of database and scripting functionality is separate from the content, is separate from the design, it allows developers at all kind of levels of technical sophistication to engage in the open source community, in the development of the product. So if people have just, let's say, some simple design skills, they can, for Scriblio, WordPress, and Omeka, they can design their own exhibit theme or their own blog theme. If they have some more sophisticated skills and they maybe know a little bit of PHP and a little coding, they can build a plugin, which will allow, and some of the things we're building are a timeline display plugin and a map display plugin. They can do little bits of code, and they can add those to the other users can choose to use those bits of code or not. Or if they've got some, you know, serious experience and serious coding ability, they can contribute to the core architecture and core code base of the product. And so that's another thing that I think these web publishing platforms are doing, is they're allowing people at all different levels of sophistication to actually help develop the products, which ends up benefiting everybody, the developers, the users, the owners of the sites, and everybody.
Fantastic. Well, I'm looking forward to the public release of the software. And again, I think we should encourage people to go to omeka.org and sign up if they're interested in having an Omeka-based exhibit on their own site. On September 25th, the website for the National Museum of African American History and Culture went live, and it's a fantastic site. It's available at nmaahc.si.edu. And for those who don't know about this, this is a museum that will join all of the museums on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. But it doesn't exist yet. It actually is about 8 years off. They're planning on opening the physical museum sometime in the next decade. And yet they've got this, you know, really terrific web presence already. And it sort of raised questions, I think, for the digital campus crew about, you know, what is the relationship between web presence and new media and physical museums? And we haven't talked a lot about museums on the podcast, and we wanted to sort of think through some of these issues about, you know, what the role is for the digital in the analog world that most museums sort of spend their time and effort and money. And maybe I'll turn this over to you first, Tom. I mean, you had checked out this site. It's quite a good site. You know, what is this relationship in terms of, you know, you've done some work on the history of museums and we've worked with some museums, actually quite a few, including some of the Smithsonian museums on new media projects. What do you see at least the state of the art and the state of this relationship in 2007 and perhaps where it's going by the time that this museum actually opens up its physical location?
Well, I do think it's interesting, and I think that museums have, since I think the very early days of the web, and I know one of my very first jobs out of college in 1996 was working with a professor at the University of Northern Colorado to do research on the web presence of history museums. And this was in 96, this is in the very early days of the web. And I actually was able to survey and actually speak to the person in charge of the website of every history museum website on the web at that time. I was actually just remembering
how, this. How many was that?
There were about 150. And so, you know, over the course of the fall of 1996, I was able to speak to virtually every history museum webmaster in the United States. So we limited it to the United States. But and of course, just like the general web, the growth of the history museum and the museum web in general has just been tremendous. And I think from very early on, and I remember talking to those webmasters, and oftentimes they weren't really even webmasters. It was someone in the education department or someone in the public programs department,
sure,
or maybe just an intern who had some web skills, putting up those sites. But even in those very early days, there was tremendous enthusiasm from the museum community about the internet. And I think that it stems from the fact that, unlike the products of the university, which are generally textual, the raw materials of the museum, which are artifactual, are very hard to extend in time and space. For the whole history of museums, you had to go to the museum to see the main product of the museum. There was no way to extend that to other audience the way it's you are able to extend, let's say, a lecture, either through recording or more conventionally through text to outside audiences. And so I think museum professionals saw the web as this way to extend their products and their artifacts and their programs to vast outside audiences. And I think they've met with very mixed success in this area, but although I think there's still tremendous hope. I think it artifacts have continued to be still kind of difficult to extend in that way. They've been in some ways very reticent, and I think museums are trying to figure out that relationship and how you extend an artifactual experience to new audiences. And so that enthusiasm, I think, translates into the fact that museums that don't necessarily even have a physical presence yet are starting to build a very, very well articulated online presences even before their physical buildings get off the ground. So I think it is a complex relationship, and it's one that continues to be very much in flux, just like it is in the library community, just like it is in the university community.
Yeah, but I have to say, I hate to be the contrarian on this, but I have seen so few museum websites that I thought were remotely good. And the reason that I think this is because they're all just trying to just show you what they have. And they're so few. I mean, like I think the Cooper Hewitt is maybe one exception to my complaint here, but so few of them really embrace what is possible to do with digital media. Instead, they just see the internet as a way of showing you what they have and making it possible for you to see the whole collection. Isn't that wonderful? And they just it's like they're afraid to do things that might be new and interesting and engaging to a new audience. And I got to say, I think that they're going to completely lose the rising generation of young people around the world if they don't kind of wake up and say, showing you an image of this great painting we have is just boring.
Well, aren't they trying to catch that group by not the website, which I would agree that in many cases is often sort of a brochure, a kind of online brochure for, hey, come and visit us, because then you get to see the real stuff. And here are some tiny thumbnails of the real stuff. you know, isn't it the in exhibit, you know, what used to be the big boxy computer monitors are now jazzy, cool flat screens that are meant to be like, you know, the flame that attracts the moths that are our kids over to that realm, and to have some kind of interactive, you know, in the gallery exhibit. So, you know, the parents are there checking out the real stuff, the painting, and the kids are, you know, looking at some video or interactive entertainment.
Sure. I mean, and I think that that's absolutely true that they've done. I'm not talking about what they're doing in the museums. I was really talking about their websites. I think that in the museums have done some really interesting and creative things. And certainly, you know, I have a child in middle school, a child in elementary school, and when we go into a museum or a, you know, an aquarium or, you know, any place like that, they gravitate to the interactive screen. Or any other sort of hands-on manipulative possibility in the museum. So I think the museums in the physical space, they've done a much better job of this. But online, they're just not doing it. And go ahead,
you know,
Tom.
I think it's interesting that in some ways I think that reflects the way that many museums are structured organizationally, institutionally, where there's a kind of front of the house and back of the house, where there's the public programs people on the one hand and the education people on the one hand and the curators and the registrars on the other hand. And they oftentimes don't work very closely or very well together. And so I think in the galleries, you're seeing the products of the front of the house people. And I think often online, you're seeing the product of the back of the house people, the curators, who really, I think one of the reasons why so many of these museums, online museums, are just kind of catalogs is because that's when they first started building their website, that's where they started. They already had a digitized catalog of their collections.
Right.
They already had a database, a collections management database. And oftentimes what happened was, and for that reason, the information technology people worked for the curators. And so often what you see is simply just a translation of that collections management database to the online web environment. And that's sort of what they've been able to do so far. And in many respects, the education people and the front of the house people have been, I don't want to say excluded, but left out of that. And so I think that's where you see in many cases that divide. And I think the front of the house people are only starting to get involved. And I know we've seen this tension with our we have a project at CH&M called The Object of History, where we're working with curators at the National Museum of American History to provide a richer experience around material cultural objects. Than new models for providing rich experiences around rich educational experiences around material culture than has been done in the past. And we've seen this kind of tension between the front of the house and the back of the house, and maybe tension is also too strong a word, but there is a divide, and I think that is reflected in the various new media presences that that museums have.
Yeah, and I can give you a very specific example of that, and I don't want to actually name the museum because we're still in conversations with them about this, but I met with some people in the front of the house, as you put it, from a museum not too long ago about using digital media as a way of substantially expanding their collection, because their particular focus is an area of the arts where the collector community actually owns far more of the objects that they collect, that this museum collects and displays. The private collectors own far more than the museum owns and ever will own. And so I said, you know, here's a great way to really do something exciting and interesting, and say, go to your members, because they have lots of members of their museum. Go to your membership and say, if you will provide us with all the data that our curators require, you know, the provenance of the object and all of that sort of metadata about the object, and you will also provide us with images of a quality that we dictate, we will add that object to our digital collection. And so it's like you've loaned us the object, except you just loaned us a digital version of the object. And you could massively expand the quality of your and the breadth of the collection of the museum. And further, you would bond all of those collectors to your organization because they could get to say, oh, yeah, well, and I have this wonderful thing. And look, it's part of the website collection of this My Favorite Museum. And so you'd be much more likely to donate money to the museum on a regular basis and that kind of thing. But and the people at the front of the house said, wow, that is a fantastic idea. And then they said, and our curators will never agree.
Right.
Because they don't actually accession the object. They don't control the object. It's only a digital version, and they'll just never go for that. And I said, well, Jesus Christ, fire them and get some new curators who have their heads screwed on straight, because this is a way to do some really exciting things with, you know, and one of the problems that Tom alluded to earlier was you know, how do you have that kind of personal experience with an object when you're only looking at it on the computer? But it is possible to do that kind of thing in some interesting ways. And unless the front of the house and the back of the house can start talking to each other, I think museums are just flushing incredible quantities of money down the drain when it comes to their digital media.
Yeah, I mean, isn't the big problem here that very thing that, you know, the hesitant curator, the older, you know, people, and they don't need to be that old, who still have a kind of reverence for the actual physical object over a digital copy. Isn't that the real tension? I mean, the problem is you have these millennials and you know, the younger set who's coming up with really little to no reverence for the original object. I mean, the reason we go to a museum to see something that very well could be reduced in incredibly high fidelity and, you know, made available in a very, you know, high resolution image online. But, you know, I think the three of us, we still have that kind of gene in us, the reverence for the actual physical object, the reason that museums exist. And isn't that going to be the big tension over this generation when you think about new media in museums about, you know, well, how much primacy do we give to the actual object? You know, how do we get past that? You know, I wrote a blog post on this where about artists and digital media, you know, because I went to a bunch of museums this summer and I was amazed by all these contemporary artists you would think would be flocking to digital media and, you know, using it to the utmost and distributing their artwork online, and yet they don't. You know, they're concerned about it too. You know, and people wrote to me saying, well, they've got to make a living, they've got to sell artwork. But still, you'd think, you know, of any group, artists are tend to be the most radical. They're trying new things out. They're the first people to use film. They're the first people to use photography. They're first people to use computers in many cases. And so, and yet they love the physical object. There's still that attachment to placing something in a gallery where people have to sort of trek to the museum to see it, rather than to see a copy of it online. I mean, how do we get past that reverence and that very deep-seated feeling that I think a lot of people have?
Well, I go ahead, Tom.
Well, I mean, I think I think many museums, and I think the future of the museum requires that reverence for the real object remain. I do think that the purpose in or at least a major purpose of museums is to protect and conserve those original objects. But I think that what we have to figure out is how new media enhances the experience of the original object rather than replaces the experience of the original
object. Yeah, I think
object.
That's well put.
And I think that's what we haven't figured out yet. I know we're thinking about a project and working on a proposal for a project where we use digital media to help students better understand scientific instruments. Scientific instruments, historic scientific instruments, can be revered in their own right, and they're interesting to look at. Oftentimes, you know, they're you know, especially early modern scientific instruments are works of art, and very interesting just to look at under a glass case. But fundamentally, scientific instruments are objects that were intended to be used, used in a laboratory context, or used in a classroom context, or used in a demonstration context. And there's just no way to provide the experience of use of an original object without letting giving people access to it, hands-on access to touch it and manipulate it. And these are objects which, unlike many art objects which were intended to sit still, these were objects that were intended to be manipulated and to move. And there's just no way to provide that experience, that real experience of the real object in the gallery. Aside from new media. And so one of the things we want to explore is how can new media enhance the experience of that original object and teach us something, not replace it, not just provide a representation of it, but actually provide a more honest experience of that object than you get in the museum. So that's the kind of enhancement I think I'm talking about.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And just to give you an example, in the Museum of Applied Arts in Vienna, they have one of the most amazing rug collections in the world. I mean, they have these late 16th, early 17th century rugs from Central Asia and Anatolia, and they're just spectacular works of art. And if you go into the room where they're displayed, I mean, you know, they're objects to be revered. And one of the things that's really, really nice about that particular room in that particular gallery is that you can get really close to the rugs. They're down on the floor, and you just behind little lucite panels that are only about 2 feet high. And you can, as long as you don't actually lean over the panels, you can get really close to the actual textile, to this thing and see it really well. But you still can't get so close that you can see the weave. And you can see it as a work of art, but you can't see the warp and the weft itself. And that's what you could do in a digital environment, is that the curators there could then, you know, work with that object instead of just having it lying there flat on the floor and nicely available to you. They could show you all sorts of the intricacy of the craft of the person who created, or the team of people who created that object. And that's something that you could never do in any museum, but you can do in a digital environment. The other piece to this is that it's a question of audience. I mean, how many people does the museum want to have the experience of the object? Because if it's just the number of people who can come in, or is it everybody? And so if these kinds of really rich experiences are created, they're experiences that are created for people who will never make it to Vienna to the Museum of Applied Arts.
That's a great point. You know, the web presence is, you know, from this point forward will be by far, by several orders of magnitude, the largest number of visitors for every museum, right? I went to a conference on Friday at the National Endowment for the Humanities in Washington, and there was a researcher for the Italian version of the NEH, which is called the CNR, and he was talking about the websites, the traffic to websites for Italian museums like the Uffizi, which gets a lot of foot traffic. You know, it gets hundreds of thousands of people a year, but it gets tens of millions of people a year on the web. And that ratio will only increase. I mean, there's a maximum number of people, and I guess, although I've been to Florence and it seems like they pack them all in at the same time, but there's still a maximum number of people that fit in there per day, 365 days a year. But the web presence will increasingly sort of mark a museum, and I think both of you are right. I hadn't thought about it, but you know, thinking, you know, museum curators and their public groups who, you know, work to put their stuff online, I think need to think about, you know, what's the way in which our objects can be shown in a new way, enhanced, extended online, versus just Mills, what you started talking about of, you know, what are the hours, where are the bathrooms, that sort of stuff that you often see foregrounded on the website right now. It's time once again for our lightning round, going around the horn, and as the three of us talk about sites or resources or software that we found over the past couple of weeks that we think would be useful for the audience. Let's start with you this week, Mills.
Well, mine is actually it's a blog that's it appears on the New York Times, and it's from the on the New York Times website, and it's from the filmmaker Errol Morris, and he's done documentaries, he's done feature films, he's won Oscars or at least one Oscar, and it's an investigation of two photographs by the Crimean War era photographer Robert Fenton. The crucial photograph is the one that's displayed all the time. It's called The Valley of the Shadow of Death. And Morris is investigating in two very long blog posts. He's got a third coming up. Which of the two photographs came first? There's one of this road that is just littered with cannonballs, and that's the one that shows up in the history books. And then there's one that is the road with no cannonballs. And there's been lots of debate about whether Fenton placed all those cannonballs out there or if he took all the cannonballs away or which of the photographs came first. And so it's a long investigation by Morris of trying to understand not only why the scholars on this all disagree with each other, because they really do disagree with each other, but also how you could figure out the truth of the matter. And so it's the blog posts are called Which Came First? And he actually goes to the trouble of going to the Crimea and Sevastopol to get in the exact same spot that Fenton was in when he took the photographs. And it's a really interesting example of how one can investigate a particular historical problem like this. And so it's just a really great two-part post, and I'm looking forward to the third and final installment, which should be out shortly.
I am too. I read every single word of both of those long posts. And they really are. They could have been long articles in the New Yorker or the Atlantic Monthly or something like that. They're just fascinating. And also to hear from the experts about which came first is really great. I also would encourage people to read through this. And again, we'll link to this from our website, digitalcampus.tv. Tom, what do you have for this week?
Well, after the last segment, I was feeling a little bad because I think there are some really fantastic bloggers and museum professionals thinking about the things we were talking about. And I think we shouldn't close out the podcast before mentioning it, at least one of them. My pick for this week is a blog called Museum 2.0, and it's written by Nina Simon, and she is a museum exhibit designer, multimedia designer, who has worked at the International Spy Museum and elsewhere. And she has this blog, Museum 2.0, which is really one of the very best blogs I've read on any topic, and I would say probably the most thoughtful voice on museums and multimedia, both online and in the gallery that's out there. Nina's blog is at museum2.blogspot.com. She's been blogging for just about a year, and she posts very frequently and at extraordinary length. I just don't know how she's able to do it, but it is a fantastic resource, and I encourage people to go there because there are some really great people thinking very, very deeply about just the issues we raised in the main segment.
A great blog. Good pointer there, Tom. Thanks. I have a website, or actually a sort of web service for this week called YouConvertIt, and I'm teaching a grad class in digital history. And one of the things that I found to be really difficult for students, and actually pretty much everyone else, is figuring out how to get one type of file to another kind of file. So, students in my class who are blogging and have taken a photograph, let's say, on their phone and want to email it to themselves and then somehow get on their blog, but it comes out in some strange, bitmap format or some kind of weird format that they don't know, you can just go to youconvertit.com, and this will convert pretty much from any format to any format. So, I mean, literally they have a dozen different kinds of video formats. For images, I think it's a few score. I mean, most of these I've never even heard of. But it's a really great resource because I think a lot of people don't really sort of, they might not have a copy, let's say, on hand of Photoshop. But even Photoshop, to do this conversion, might not have some of these different kinds of types. So I think this is really handy if you want to sort of get from one format to another. For instance, if you've got a QuickTime video, which is a .mov file, and you want to convert that into an MPEG format, it'll just go ahead and do that for you and then email you the file. So very handy little service online, youconvertit.com. Well, that wraps it up for this week, but we hope you join us again in 2 weeks for another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a bi-weekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 4 for April 18th, 2007. Welcome to The Social. I'm Dan Cohen, this week's host. Well, welcome to another episode of Digital Campus. We are here once again with the regulars. I'm Dan Cohen, as you just heard in the introduction, and can be found at dancohen.org. And we also have with us today Mills Kelly from edwired.org. Hey, Mills.
Hey, Dan. How are you today?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. A little cold, but pretty well.
Yeah, we have a vicious April storm outside. And we also have with us Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org. Hey, Tom.
Hey, guys.
How's it going?
It's all right. It's
good.
All right.
Good. Well, we have a lot to discuss today, so I'm going to jump right in and actually just lead off with a little bit of what happened last week, and Tom's going to talk a little bit about what he's experienced in terms of two different conferences. So there's been a lot going on with